Well, the trailer for the second season of Graham Hancock's Netflix sensation Ancient Apocalypse has been posted on YouTube, and the thumbnail shows those famous Moai from Easter Island. Rapa Nui is what the indigenous people call it. And for those of you who've watched my channel in the past, you know that Rapa Nui is pretty much my favorite location for Atlantis. Even though it's in the Pacific, I still think that this is most likely what was referred to in the legends and myths as Atlantis. Now, since Graham is obviously going to be getting into a lot of detail on this, and I already get accused of riding his coattails bad enough as it is, figure I better get out in front of this one. Instead of just giving you the little tidbits like I did in my 25,000 subscriber special, I'll get into some of the papers and some of the logical reasons as to why I think this might actually be Atlantis. If there was an Atlantis, in my opinion, Easter Island is our best candidate. So let's get into it. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to Dunking. Now, since every time I mention Atlantis, I get the same response from a handful of people, and for some reason this argument tends to, like, land well in some other people's brains, I figure I better address it now because it's not much of an argument. Alright, the idea that Plato just wrote about Atlantis purely as an allegory and there was nothing to see here, it's just to make a socio-political point, is kind of superficial. First of all, we have no way of knowing whether or not he was referencing a real place or an imaginary place, right? Obviously. But more importantly, if you look at modern examples of this, I mean, we all have seen the people online, no matter what side of the political spectrum, that are like, oh, the West is falling, everything's going to hell. And those people, do they tend to cite Camelot? Or do they cite the Roman Empire as their example? When they make their allegory, when they draw their metaphor, they go to a real place, because otherwise their argument has no teeth. If they're arguing about what happens on Mickey Mouse or on Harry Potter, nobody really is going to take that seriously. So in my opinion, the idea that Plato used a place that was considered fictitious by his audience to make his allegory, to make his point, is kind of silly, is kind of a smooth brain take. Okay, having addressed that, let's move forward and talk about the real meat of this video. So let's talk about Easter Island, or Rapa Nui, or Te Pito o Te Huana. I'm sure I pronounced that really right, but that last thing, that means the navel of the world. And that's one of the names for the island, and that's freaking weird. Not that the Polynesians had a navel of the world. That's not so weird. What's weird is where they put it. That's like the furthest flung corner of the Polynesian Empire, right? Then that is not normal for a world navel. Normally, these centers are centers of culture. They put it in the oracle at Delhi, or in Jerusalem, or in Cuzco, or in temples in India. These weren't in far-flung regions. These weren't, like, hard-to-reach places. These were places that everybody could get to. It's the navel. It's the center of the world, man. It shouldn't be that inaccessible. But for whatever reason, in this situation, the navel of the world is as far away as you could possibly get from the rest of the culture, the rest of that culture. And that's pretty weird to begin with. The Polynesians sure picked a weird freaking place to put their navel of the world. And that's kind of the myth about the peopling of Easter Island. The King Hoto Matua, I'm sure I pronounced his name right too, he was said to have had a dream where the island he was living on was going to sink, so he sent 7 people out to find another place to live. They found Easter Island, left one dude there, 6 came back, said, hey, let's go, King. And Hoto Matua and his old entourage went and settled Easter Island, and they lived happily ever after until the slavers showed up, and it's like 1700s. My point here is, there was 2 expeditions to the island in more modern times, in the peopling of it in the Polynesian era, and this is actually kind of backed up by the scientific evidence, which we'll discuss in a minute. But first I want to really get into just what I think about what Easter Island Atlantis consisted of. What am I looking at here? Just a bunch of freaking Polynesians riding around in boats? No. I believe the area of Southeast Asia and Oceania once housed a culture that was considered advanced by their contemporaries. They don't have, like, lost ancient high technology levels of advanced. Most people would not consider what I think of them to be advanced technology, but for its time, it certainly was. Advanced seamanship in the regards they were navigating properly. They were using the stars. They were using the sun. They were navigating. They weren't just being like, oh, hope we float the right direction here. They were using ropes and knots and teamwork to engage in actual seamanship. They were able to keep a far-flung group of islands that weren't so far-flung, but they were able to keep these islands that couldn't necessarily see each other connected as part of one culture by means of this ability to sail. I believe that when the climate began to change, these different islands experienced vastly different problems. Some of them would be basically cut off from all resources. Some of them would just be swallowed by the sea. Some of them would be relatively unscrewed with, right? I mean, they'd still, things wouldn't be perfect, but they would still have, if the schools of fish still passed by and they still had the same shores to harvest, they're probably okay. So as long as things didn't change too much in some places, and those places would probably be trying to reestablish some a degree of contact with others around them. Once that would be the first thing they would do once they established a degree of survivability. So I believe that these guys were basically trying hard to hold this together after the climate change. And the place was a whole lot different before that. When I was on the Limitless podcast with Matt Bell down in Florida, which was awesome, by the way, links in the description, you should totally check it out. He brought up something that was really interesting about the region.
So as I look at South America and look at Easter Island on this map, when you look at Easter Island out here in the middle of nowhere, what appears to be, if the sea level was a little bit lower, you could imagine that all of these little islands out here would have been above water. We know the sea level was 400 feet lower at the last ice age, right? Yeah. So you see basically what looks like it could be a land bridge going all the way from South America to Easter Island.
Interesting.
And I just found this on Google Earth, just randomly.
Holy crap, yeah, that's interesting.
It's crazy.
Even if it wouldn't be a land bridge, that would be a whole lot easier to traverse if there was a chain of islands.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Way easier.
Yeah, easy to navigate for sure, but it looks like it's been elevated to the point where travel would be very easy from South America. And then as you look and you go all the way over to Easter Island, you can see that continues directly to the west, and it connects with what would have been ultimately you're going to Fiji, you're going to Australia, you're going to Asia. I mean, it could have all very well have been, it looks like, connected at some point in time, you know, either easily navigable or straight up above water.
So as their society began to collapse and eventually shattered, those islands that were in a position to try to reestablish contact with their neighbors inadvertently started these myths of the seven sages and the wise men like Quetzalcoatl, who show up to teach civilization to people who had been knocked back in time a bit. And now, this group of people, these seafarers, these seven sages, you can even find their fingerprints in the Hotomatua story I told you a minute ago with the seven explorers finding the island. These guys brought with them astronomy and the idea of a world navel, and their superior astronomy would allow their culture to supplant the places that they showed up. And this is something that we have historical precedent for. I'll put a link in the description to a thumbnail with whichever side I'm framed better here. We'll put a thumbnail, and you there's a video on archaeoastronomy where I do go into a good degree of detail on how one culture will just kind of kowtow to another when they show up with considerably better ways to touch the gods. Now, the world navel thing, though, is really what's impressive here, again, because we're talking about Rapa Nui, right? We're Easter Island. So let's go back to that world navel for a minute. Now, if Easter Island was the center of the world to this culture, or the last remaining piece of a landmass that once housed the center of the world, it stands to reason that any survivors of that culture would have that place high on their list of areas to look for. I mean, it's the capital of their community, right? So it makes sense that the Hotomatua story incorporates a flood threatening their island. I believe that's basically them taking like one big event and boiling it down into a small story. Island gets flooded, we look for the old capital. And now we can't say that for certain, but what we can say for certain is when they got to Easter Island, when they got to Rapa Nui, they really, it's a hard place to reach to begin with. It's not a good place to go to eke out a living. And then when they got there, they didn't just turn around and start, like, cultivating the land and farming and shit. They started building big moai. They started, like, spending tons of their GDP, like, making a memorial of the place in a way that really isn't done anywhere else in the region, except for way down in South America when they make those big-ass Olmec heads. But you don't really see the Polynesians doing this kind of work pretty much anywhere else. It's really, really enigmatic. And in my opinion, it is enigmatic like this because they did not show up here to survive like they do on most other islands. They weren't showing up here to colonize like they were on most other islands. They were showing up here to honor a sacred site. So they show up there and just pour their labor into it. Once they find the place, they don't give a fuck how far it is away, and they don't give a fuck what it takes to do when they get there. They pour labor into this place like nothing else we see in the region, because they believed they were at the seat of an old empire. Now, as many are already yelling at me through the screen, Dan, you have no evidence for what you're saying. And you know, on a scientific level, I don't. I'm talking about, like, I believe in the myth of Atlantis probably has a grain of truth to it. So just like a guy looking for the sea peoples, I'm looking for things that will fit. And this seems to fit pretty well, actually. And there's some things about Easter Island that science is coming in and weighing in on is overturning dogma that would stop the ideas that I'm talking about here. For example, a guy named Thor Heyerdahl back in the 1950s posited that the stonework in Peru and the stonework on Easter Island, something influenced each other. They were connected somehow. He wasn't sure how, but they were connected. Now, this was mocked heavily, laughed at, ha ha ha, lol, silly, silly, rocks look like rocks, look like rocks. But in more recent years, science has been, this year, science has basically borne it out and said, yeah, that's a really, really, really good possibility that's accurate. But guys like Thor faced a lot of backlash because there's certain fields of science where there's a little bit of extra room for interpretation, like archaeology or anthropology, that tend to draw out the ego in people when you challenge them. And, well, we see that at Easter Island because of its, well, here we are with maybe my connection to Atlantis. Blame it on me, I guess. But that's a side point. The science actually shows a few things, and one of them is the dating of Easter Island, the peopling of Easter Island, may be way off. One of the things that they use to date the peopling of a region in the Polynesian area is ants. And now, just imagine being an archaeologist and you're out there sifting a screen for fucking ant parts from 1,000 years ago. Whoo, what a great job that would be. But at any rate, they sift these little things out and they test them and they identify the species and they test the carbon and they use these as a means to date the region. Some of these species of ants were said to have, like, come over on boats. So I guess, I don't know, they had a pet queen or the queen would hide on the boat or something, whatever. The idea is that some of these species of ants did not come here without humans helping them. And that's one way that they date numerous things in the area of Polynesia. And that's a big, big deal because the dating on these ants is so far back. It's like 2,000 years older than it should be. So either the peopling of Easter Island is wrong, or fundamentally one of the main things that's used to date the whole Oceania region in ancient times, the peopling of different areas, is flawed. There's basically three different hypotheses total as to what could be the thing. I'll read it from the paper. We consider possible explanations for the older-than-expected Rapa Nui ant dates. 1. People visited Rapa Nui and therefore presumably other, less remote islands in eastern Polynesia millennia before the currently accepted time of settlement, inadvertently introducing ants. However, to our knowledge, none of these numerous archaeological excavations and other examinations encompassing virtually all eastern Polynesian islands, including Rapa Nui, show evidence to support this. Also, plant microfossil, mostly pollen, sediment cores from elsewhere in eastern Polynesia, including other Rapa Nui wetlands, show no convincing proxy evidence supporting this. 2. The ants are indigenous to Rapa Nui. Based on more thorough surveys, Morrison found that remote Polynesian islands generally were not as depauperate in terms of ant species as previously thought. Late quaternary fossil arthropods in remote Oceania are under research, to our knowledge limited to only one previously published study, also from Rapa Nui, and this does not report ants. Fisher discussed oceanic ant dispersal, noting floating vegetation as a mechanism, and also that newly inseminated queens take wings to establish new colonies, and they can be blown across the open ocean. Foracy is a dispersal mechanism also worth considering, especially given that the prehistoric seabird fauna of Rapa Nui probably exceeded 30 species, more than are known from any other single Polynesian island. In addition, passive internal dispersal of insects, dead or alive, via animals, especially birds in our case, cannot be ruled out. 3. The ants had been ingesting old carbon within food webs in the catchment. This is suggested by their apparent ages older than those of the plant macrofossils from around the same depths. Bevy and Affield et al. Dated modern rats from New Zealand up to 2,000 years old. That case involved the transfer of 14C depleted carbon to lake waters by geothermal venting, which aquatic plants fix into the food chain. And the paper ends with the following statement. If Rapa Nui ants are indigenous, this has implications for ant introduction versus indigenousness elsewhere in the Polynesia, and therefore for using fossil ants as an indicator of human presence. In other words, the anomalous nature of the carbon that they're finding in these ants and the ants themselves are basically forcing them to either say Rapa Nui needs to have its peopling reevaluated, or the entire region may need to have its peopling reevaluated. Anywhere where ants were a linchpin freaking thing for them to decide what it was, they might need to revisit that. But there's other stuff that's going on there too. As far as the dating goes, there's actually reason to believe there might have been two separate peoplings of that area. We find this through charcoal and pollen deposits in that same study. I'll read from it. Also in this sample, charcoal first appears in a very high concentration. Sophora, Triumpheta, and especially Arecasaria dominate the pollen sum from 17.2 centimeters depth through the overlying layers up to the corp detritus at 15.75 meters depth. Charcoal was not present in the samples from the fine detritus layers at 16.8 and 16.4 meter depths. Resuming in the subsequent samples, including one with another very high concentration, Skipperus and Polygallum pollen appears in very large amounts around these depths. Triumpheta pollen peaks sharply around 16 meter depths, and Polygrum pollen declines shortly thereafter, followed by a peak in the monolet fern spores. Charcoal disappears after 16 meters depth. Small amounts of Athropathathatha spores were found in the upper clay layers and in the few subsequent samples from the overlying coarse detritus. Arecasaria, Sophora, and Triumpheta pollen continue to feature in the coarse detritus, with an increase in Poaceae pollen after 12.5 meter depths. Charcoal appears again in small amount in one sample at the 11 meter depth. Arecasaria pollen declines dramatically after 3.7 meter depth, replaced largely by Poaceae and Skipperus pollen and fern spores, the latter initially in very large amounts. There is a sustained reappearance of charcoal at this time, with particularly large initial amounts. So, with that changing in pollen and charcoal, and then a gap, and then pollen and charcoal again, it's quite possible, very good chance, that people were there in multiple different times. Maybe a pilgrimage site, maybe different attempts to settle the place. It's hard to say for sure, but it is very tantalizing. It does make me think I might just be on the right track. And here's the thing, the water levels also changed a lot then too. So when they dig down and they're like, this is the lowest level of human occupation we find, they're not digging in a place that 8,000 years ago would have been a good place to live. And they're digging in a place that was a good place to live a couple thousand years ago. So there's a pretty big difference there. The changing water levels, as you can see, are dramatic. And the thing is every time we dig deeper into this scientifically, Rapa Nui just gives us more and more weird shit, and I love it. Now, twice in 2024, we've had major breakthroughs in the history of Easter Island. The first one I want to talk about is they took a bunch of obsidian blades that were taken from Akapena, which is the oldest site with a confirmed cultural layer. It goes back about 800 to 1,000 years. Now, those blades had a bunch of starch grains in them, and they pulled them out, and they were able to find breadfruit and ginger and sweet potato, and basically there's things from South America and from Asia in this group of people, their earliest layer. as far as mainstream academia is concerned, the very first group of people that settled there, this is what they had, was foods from both South America and Asia. Now the paper is linked below, and it's long, but I'll read a little bit from it so you can get an idea of what I'm saying here. The unexpected finding of three species, i.e. breadfruit, Tahitian apple, and ginger, not previously recorded for Rapa Nui, requires some discussion. Breadfruit is thought to have been domesticated somewhere in island Southeast Asia and Western Melanesia, including New Guinea, and was dispersed by humans since at least early Lepidid times, is one of the most important food plants of the Pacific. According to the literature, breadfruit is not considered part of the suite of plants that reached Rapa Nui. Some authors have discussed that, if ever present, it did not survive because of the subtropical climate conditions of the island. There are only two previous archaeological records for the presence of breadfruit in the wider region of East Polynesia. The first corresponds to starch grains attached to shell artifacts dated to 1400 to 1600 AD in the Marquesas, and the second corresponds to the charred exocarp remains of the late contacts of the Society Islands. Our findings therefore represent the third and earliest record of the species in the archaeological context of East Polynesia. And these groundbreaking histories of the foodstuffs also extends to Asia. In this case, we'll talk about ginger. The finding of four archaeological starch grains identified with high probability, 90% or so, as ginger on three obsidian tools is, to our knowledge, the first evidence that this species was introduced to Easter Island during early settlement. As stated above, this result was unexpected, particularly as this species is not mentioned in legends, nor was it described by any of the early European explorers or visitors to Rapa Nui. Although there might be previous clues for this highly valued spice in the Society Islands, we consider this result with great caution while waiting for additional and independent evidence for its presence in Rapa Nui. Now, these all show up at the earliest human signs of habitation, like I said, which says that the people that showed up there brought foodstuffs from both Asia and South America with them, which flies in the face of what the criticisms to guys like Thor Heyerdahl. Remember I mentioned him earlier and how he said that Rapa Nui and Peru had similar architecture and therefore one influenced the other, and that was just mocked because there's no way there was contact between the two. Well, now we have some solid evidence that there was contact between the two. Now, obviously, genetic evidence of humans would be ideal, but we don't have that, do we? Or do we? In July of this year, a paper was published that shows evidence for South American genetic influence in the Rapa Nuian people. About 10% of their DNA, about 10% of their admixture, comes from South America, specifically from the Andes region. And not only that, but they can trace a genetic drift. They can trace it actually going and traveling further west from there through the islands and stuff into different Polynesian populations. It's all really interesting stuff. I'll go ahead and read a little bit from the paper. To reconcile these results with the previous study in which no evidence of Native American ancestry was found in ancient Rapa Nui individuals, we reanalyzed the publicly available data from Reference 6. In agreement with Reference 6, we did not obtain statistically significant D statistics suggesting that Native American admixture. However, through a downsampling experiment, we show that low depth can explain the absence of statistically significant D statistics. Furthermore, using our admixture approach, we detected a Native American-like component in 3 out of 5 previously published ancient Rapa Nui represented by low-depth sequencing data. Of course, modern genetic science is better than it was even just a few years ago, so it stands to reason that they're going to come in and kind of overturn previous findings to a degree, but what's interesting is how they went about it to different angles. They don't find what they want the first time they look, but they're pretty sure that there's something going on, so they keep looking at it from different angles until they find something that makes sense or until they've exhausted all avenues of research. And this, my friends, is the kind of scientific inquiry I love and respect. They don't go in there and they say, well, nope, can't be. Look at that, we hit the fucking brick wall and there just can't be. Like they say to Thor Heyerdahl, no, sir. In this situation, they look at it and look at it and look at it. They believe something. They think they can run with it. And they don't fake data. They don't lie about it. But if they find what they're looking for, they're going to find it if it's there. So I love and respect that type of research so much. And what has that gotten us? Now, we don't know when it was populated at first, but we do know that using ants for carbon dating or for just using the species to identify the timeline might be a little off. We know that the people that settled Rapa Nui about 1,000 years ago brought food from South America and from Asia. We know that they interbred with people from South America. We know that admixture flowed west. And I believe that as we do more research and we get better science and we start to accept better frameworks, different frameworks, and as these kinds of walls get beaten down, the Thor Heyerdahl wall of these two places cannot be connected, now that's gone, I think that we're going to start to find more and more and more about Easter Island that is just really enigmatic. I mean, look, a lot of the hypotheses that they're using here, they're based on a lot of suppositions. I mean, the genetic stuff used Bayesian models, which Bayesian models are fine, don't get me wrong, I'm not bashing the things, but there's a lot of room for inference there. Part of the purpose of these is to be able to, like, infer data that you really don't know fuck all about. And so, if your inference is thousands of years off, then you're going to end up with thousands of years off in your whole model and stuff. So I'm not saying that these guys are wrong on everything. My point is that there is a lot of room for error here, and they haven't been accepting, up until this year, the idea of South America and Easter Island directly. It was something that was combated on a mainstream level. I do think that the more that we look, the more that we put effort into it, the more that we spend time, that we're going to find that, yeah, you had to go beyond the Pillars of Hercules to get to Atlantis from Greece. But you had to go a whole lot further than that. You had to go all the way out into the Pacific. And there you would find the people whose technology, knowledge, and abilities outstripped everybody else on the planet. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to watch this far. I hope you enjoyed the video. I really want to spend a second here to thank two different people here, Doug and Tim. Both of you know exactly who the fuck I'm talking to. I want to thank both of you guys very, very, very much without going into too insane amounts of details. But thank you both very much. And I just want to thank everyone else for watching this far. I do have Patreon and Ko-Fi links down there if you would like to support the channel, you like content like this or some of the other stuff that I made. Click the buttons down below. Thank you guys very much, and we will see you next time.